Here we go. Let's take off together. Today's talk is called The Politics of Soul Politics, because I don't know if you've noticed it or if you've heard, but there's this election going on, and politics are very much in the air, or maybe slightly below the air, depending on your point of view. And I was thinking about, like, what is an alternative, not to say or badly speak about any candidates or any specific, you know, orientation for a political view, but actually to start to promote what we believe, each of us as individuals. What would that mean? So I was thinking, like, an alternative politics, not that we wouldn't still vote or be for our own candidate, but what would it mean to represent our higher aspirations? What would that mean if we were to actually believe that? And so it chose the word soul, which is a little interesting because I wanted to say a politics of heart, but then I was thinking, well, also a politics of mind, you know? And then I was thinking, well, maybe a politics of spirit, but that sounds a little Oprah-like. So I actually thought, I'm very jealous of her, she's wonderful. But soul being this idea, a translation, if you will, of a Buddhist idea called bodhicitta, or heart-mind, like the union of our mind and our heart. Masculine, feminine, left and right brain, integration. A mind that has compassion and wisdom. So a mind of wisdom might be very clear and very precise, but not very kind. And a mind of heart might be very kind and very loving, but not very clear all the time. I don't know if you're like me, but my heart has made some bad decisions. I think it was my heart. But, you know, on some level, it's like, wow, this isn't what I expected at all. Because I just shut off my higher intelligence and went with my passion. And you know what? You can't fault yourself for that. That's still a better way to go than shutting yourself up in your room, you know? But we could actually be really smart about our passion, turn it into compassion, so to speak, right? By the same token, there's intelligence, as many of us that are really bright and really smart. And one of our teachers, the founder here, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, likes to say that being right has nothing to do with compassion. Think about that. In fact, it may be an obstacle to compassion. Because if you're right, that's good, huh? Just dig your teeth into that. You can really begin to make a meal out of it and maybe wear clothes that promote your rightness or have some banners and even followers. But at what point is your right somebody else's wrong? You see what I mean? At what point does somebody else have to be wrong for us to be right? At what point do we stop listening to people because we know better already? There's a woman who's a Buddhist teacher and thinker and mostly a I Ching interpreter, Carol Anthony. I love her. And one thing that she says is, if you decide that you're going to do something out of the will of your own ego, the universe just goes, go for it, and pulls back any support it might give. And I think also when we talk about the universe, what we're talking about is life, the world, the people around us. As soon as we know everything, well, then nobody needs to help us out anymore. Oh, we might think that gets us to the head of the class. But when you're at the head of the class, you just see the wall, really, right? Or me. But, you know, in terms of really opening up to a society and being part of things, I think communication is key. And I think when we talk about soul, or in classical Buddhism, bodhicitta, this idea that the heart and mind come together with a really soulful approach to our experience, I think we're moving away from hard and fast color, gender, political delineations, you know? I think we're starting to see the world as a fluid, experience. That there are different kinds of people embodying different kinds of body with different kinds of hearts, different kinds of minds, all united with two things. They all have basic fundamental goodness, bodhicitta. They all have soul. And two, they're all bat, you know, crazy, right? We're all brilliant, and we're all wise, and we're all nuts. And if we started understanding that a little bit, that there's this brilliance to us, and there's also a craziness that happens when we don't trust it. That if we were to develop inner confidence, complete confidence, true confidence, that we actually, I believe, would relax. And that's very much a belief in the Shambhala tradition, that people are fundamentally good. That evil, quote unquote, cruelty, aggression, arrogance happens when people feel threatened, feel pushed, feel insecure, feel frightened. If you actually give people goodness, kindness, and openness, there is the belief that they will behave well. And you know, there is a subset of the population, and I would imagine that includes people in the room, so no offense if you're a psychopath, but there is a percentage of people who are clinically psychopathic, and a very small percentage of them ever commit any crimes. We talk about, and some of us more than others and more loudly than others, somebody running for office comes to mind, about how terrible things are and how awful things are and how things are going to hell in a handbasket. With thousands and thousands of people a day stop at red lights. Millions of people. Millions of people feed their children. Millions of people do the best they can every day. A small percentage of people are nuts. And a very small percentage of them actually cause any harm. You know? The real fear that we have is that we can't control the experience. We can't control our life. That's what I think. Maybe you think you can. I think the best way to control your life is not to try anything. I don't know if anybody's done that. Just pull back and sit in your bed and watch Game of Thrones again and again, because you can't fail at that. But if you try, if you go out, if you fall in love, if you get hurt, you're gonna feel pain. You're gonna feel life. And life doesn't always do what we want. It's beyond our control. It's completely beyond our control. And I don't think a belief system, a psychological, moral, ethical, or religious, or political belief system can save us. I don't believe that. When I was younger, come from a certain generation, and I always cringed at the idea that I would be one of these guys. Yeah, when I was younger, back in my day, my generation, so to speak, grew up with no belief system. You know, everything was sort of shattered. The first president I remember being excited about, well, the only first president I ever remember, was assassinated, shot. The first real public hero I had, inspiring person, I was just a little kid, but Martin Luther King was shot, you know? And slowly, in time, we start to find that a lot of our idols are things that people very naively and simply believed in the 40s and 50s. In the 60s and 70s, it had all started to fall apart. And I think in the 80s, people found belief again in money. And there was that. And that was exciting, and music and TV and everything, you know, turned around to be very commercial. I do remember that in the 80s. People would actually say that like it was a good thing. Yeah, my new record's really commercial. Oh, great. Means you sound like everyone else? Yeah, I do. And that's really true, right? For those of you that know the music business, back in the record days, right, it was better to sound like someone, right, to be a carbon copy of something so that the marketing people knew how to market you well, that's fine. That's a better job than a lot of people have, but it's not art, is it? It's not expression. It's not changing or helping the world in any way that I understand. It's just more fodder for the machine, if you will. I'll tell you a joke. I wrote this joke. do you know the band Rage Against the Machine? That's what it was like back in the day for me, but now it's Lean Against the Machine and Stay Warm. I'm a little older. less inclined to make trouble. But that doesn't mean I can't live, right? I mean, what am I supposed to do? What are you supposed to do? We shut down completely and just become cookie-cutter copies of everything. I'm suspicious of beliefs. I'm suspicious of grand ideas. I'm suspicious of the idea that we could follow a belief that's better than someone else's. I'm also, with all respect, suspicious that people understand when they say things like God or the universe, which I just said, or eternity. None of us are saying the same things, are we? I went to church. We were very homogeneous in our view of the Lord when I was a child, and I know for a fact that all of us had a different idea. Does that make sense? And it seems like nothing lasts, not even our belief systems, not anything that lasts. And one thing that attracted me to Buddhism was the idea that it's based on the principle that nothing lasts. Bam! Can't beat death, so find a philosophy that builds itself upon the fact that everything ends, including its own philosophy. When I was young, I was a bit of a smart butt, and I was very difficult as a comedian in New York, and then I moved away to a Dharma center to learn to meditate, to get off certain medications I have self-prescribed. And to find something real in the world. It was the 80s and the comedy world, and there was all this stuff, and it was like, what is real here? Where's the heart? Where's the soul? So I moved away to this religious community, or so I thought. I found out it wasn't really. It was a Shambhala community. I thought it might be a cult, which sounded sexy and exciting, and then I found out that Shambhala is way too disorganized to be a cult. And that at its core are some really brilliant teachings, not about being Shambhala, or even about being a Buddhist, but about being human. What it is to be human, teachings that are pointing me to my experience and saying that my experience is really my highest judge, you know? Not my experience filtered through what my parents taught me, not my experience filtered through some idea of what I think it should be. Not my experience that I think is going to impress other people if I translate it that way, but my direct experience. That was pretty amazing. And one of my teachers at that time was explaining how everything is a trip. Anything could be a trip. The trip is the word they used to use back in the 70s when Trungpa Rinpoche first started the communities, meaning you're going off on your own thing, right? So, you know, meditation could be a trip if you start judging other people who don't meditate, right? Mm-hmm. Or complaining about your partner who doesn't meditate. There's a wonderful story that Suzuki Roshi, who is a Zen master, a woman asked him, I have a hard time meditating in the morning because my husband is in bed asleep. And Suzuki Roshi said, well, he might be meditating. All we know is you're not. You know, it really is that, right? We can't really judge. And as soon as we start judging, it's a bit of a trip, right? Whatever it is, our religion, our politics, our anything, all of a sudden we start separating ourselves from other people instead of communicating with them. And he was talking about how this journey I was on, this Buddhist path, was deconstructing all of those trips and trying to find out what was essential. Of course, I had to say, well, isn't Buddhism a trip? And he said, yes, it's just one that deconstructs itself over and over again, right? And it really is the way my experience has been, and I think some of you that have been meditating longer might have the same experience. The very things we thought it was going to be when we came in, we refine it. And all of a sudden it became something a little deeper. One of our teachers, Shambhala teachers, Pema Chodron, wonderful teacher, it's likened it to that we're walking around, we think we're normal, and we think we're, you know, connecting to other people, but we're really walking around in this really kind of underwater garb, or like a moon suit. She's often called it that too. Like we're walking around in a space suit of protection and ideas and concepts. And when we get into a spiritual path, we sort of pull all that off. And we begin to walk, we think, nakedly, because we're now Buddhists, but we realize that we still have long johns on. And we take those off and realize we still have these ugly underwear on. That there's always layers to the onion, and there really is no end game. Which puts us back on this thing. What's the point if there's no end game? What's the point if there's no grand scheme? What's the point if there's no belief system that's solid? Well, maybe the point is now. It's just what's here right now. And maybe if you have trouble believing in the left or the right, or the up or the down, maybe it's time to begin to start believing in right here, right? Your politics. What is it that your heart believes? And if you drop all of the voices saying you should do this and you should do that and you should feel this way and you should feel that way, I believe your essential voice is going to be pretty good. And then if you do what's right for you, you're inherently or innately, or what's the word? You're easily going to do what's right for other people. And you'll know better what to say. That if we begin to open the heart, right, and let the heart be without shutting down the mind, we bring these things together, right? We have a compassionate clarity. In the I Ching, in very ancient wisdom, they like to say, as the person, so the couple, as the couple, so the family, so the state. As the state, so the world. In other words, Lauryn Hill says, everything is everything. That's my last 80s reference. But, right? Like, if we are right within our own heart, and we start to really clarify that for ourselves, then we could be right in our own life. And if that becomes kind of clear and awake, then that will give off to other people. If you're paying money on the New Jersey Turnpike, if you had a moment just to look into that person's eyes and smile, not too much, not too creepy. That would be weird. You know, you got to figure that one out. That's right. Can't just like. Yeah, because then that's us putting our trip right on someone else. But just this, this idea. I'm really sorry. I'm going to digress. I can't help it. Jimmy Carr, you know, he's a comedian, and he has a joke where he'll stand up there and go, "I'm very nervous. Helping me with my nerves is the fact that I'm imagining you all in your underwear." Mm-hmm. And then he goes. So to some extent, I mean, I'm going to try to swing that back into the talk here, but the idea that we can go too far with all of it, and then it becomes a trip, right? All of a sudden it's like, oh, I went to this talk at Shambhala, can I hug you? Can I be in your space now because I'm open, right? It's really a matter of just finding the middle way, perhaps. And I think the middle way is something that a lot of people kind of eschew a bit. I did. I had a hard time, right? Bill does. Sorry. He's already going. Why is the middle way equated with flossing the teeth for, like, you know, rockers from the 90s? But, you know, the fact of the matter is the mind works more effectively when it's not in an extreme state. An extreme state might be a breakthrough for you. I have a very dear friend who I think is a brilliant teacher who had been hospitalized for a psychological break, some people called it. She called it her shamanic awakening, and it worked. And she just refused to see that that was a bad thing, right? But you can't live there, right? You can't really live there. So to actually bring that kind of awakening, or bring whatever experience we have on psychedelics, or whatever experience we have with religion, or extreme retreats, or whatever experience we have, wherever it is, and bring it into the real world. Since this is an open house, I do want to say, I don't want to sound like an infomercial, but I do want to say that that is, I think, what the path is here. It's very much bringing these ideas and making them real. Not so much grand ideas out there that nobody really understands. Liberty, what is that? What does that mean, right? Freedom, what does that mean? What do those things mean? And is it worth actually killing people for when we don't really know what those things are? So I think the idea here is to become clear about who we are and what we are. Does that make sense? So the precursor to that, I think, is to begin to accept what we are. So here's the logic. The logic is a convoluted or extreme or agitated mind really can't see clearly. Sometimes because it can't see reality clearly, I will open to the fact that it can see grand spiritual things, perhaps, you know? But it can't really activate those things in real time. Does that make sense? For any of you that write, I have written such great stuff. Mm-hmm. And I woke up in the morning and was like, what? Right? When we're in an extreme state, it seems like tremendous. But it's a whole different thing to take our singing in the shower and actually put it on stage in front of people, right? It's a whole different thing to activate all these dreams that we have and make them real without ruining the passion. So to bring the practicality of Earth along with the brilliance and inspiration of heaven is part of the path. And that those are the opposites coming together again. The sort of basic components of life, but with some practical inspiration. What would a practical inspiration be for you? And if you don't have one, that's okay. But wouldn't it be interesting if we did? We have a saying that there are three motivations to practice. This is a take home for you. The base motivation is to feel better. And that's okay. That's really okay. I actually teach in some of these new meditation studios, little half-hour meditation, guided meditation sessions. That's as far as we're going to go in a lot of those situations, you know? Making people feel better, making them in touch with their wellness. But there's another step you can take with more serious immersion in meditation, like taking classes like we have here, doing retreats, deepening your practice. And that is the second fold meditation, is to actually wake up, actually begin to go beyond ourselves. And when that's our motivation, our practice might not always be fun. Might not always make us feel better. Does that make sense? Because we're digging up stuff to get underneath there. But the process is, if we dig that stuff up, we begin to learn about that gnarly, dark stuff we don't want anybody to know. All of a sudden, we actually start to see there's really nothing there under the bed, but the remnants of a frightened child, you know? There's just our wounded feelings that actually need to come out. And when that starts to happen, we start to realize other people are frightened, scared, lonely, depressed. And the third motivation is when we start meditating for their benefit, for the benefit of the world. And I know there's activists and many that I admire and kind of find very sexy, you know, the various Occupy movements and stuff, but I do believe, as a Buddhist, that the first step has to be quieting the mind. That just going out and reacting against the pain and difficulty of the world is only going to create more. So until the mind is still, it can't be clear. Does that make sense? So the first stage, taking care of ourselves, is clarifying the mind and settling the mind. The second stage is getting past all of our hang-ups, beginning to see them, so that the mind can really clarify. And then the third stage is making it real, doing something in the world with that, dedicating our practice and our life for the betterment of the world. But not the betterment of our little section of the world at the expense of everyone else in the world. Does that make sense? But really beginning to open ourselves up. Okay, all of that is predicated upon the idea of respecting yourself first. If you don't recognize your own basic fundamental goodness, if you don't trust yourself, then anything you learn in this life is like beautiful clothes over an unshowered body. You know, eventually it's all going to degrade and get funky, because no matter how much money you get, if you don't like yourself, it's never going to be enough. Does that make sense? So I'd like us to do a little meditation together, very short. I know we just did a long one. And this will be a guided meditation. So for those of you that are new, this is not the basic meditation at Shambhala. This is me guiding us to kind of make the point here experiential. Okay. So you could close your eyes and just come into your personal space and bring yourself into yourself, if you will. There's a lot said in spiritual paths and Buddhism too about egolessness, selflessness. But we really have to find out what's here before we can make it less. And I think if we're fighting what's here, if we're embarrassed about what's here, if we don't believe in what's here, we're always running away from ourselves. And if we're always running away from ourselves, we never find it. A friend of mine once said, when you get on the wrong train, every stop is the wrong stop. So when we're getting off on our morning, already believing that we're late and we're not good enough, and things aren't working for us, and we've got to catch up with everyone else, we're sort of starting on the wrong path, right? So just bring yourself very physically into your own body. Now, the upright posture, if you're willing to go into that, you don't have to. If you are, one thing about sitting upright is it allows the mind to settle on a deeper level. So slumping to relax, while it may be satisfying in some ways, actually compresses the organs, creates more stress to the body. So sitting up straight allows everything to work and flow. And to begin to teach the body how to sit up in a posture of confidence begins to give the mind confidence. We start believing the stories when we're slumped over or puffed up. But it all starts happening right here in our gut. Bring your attention to your own body. And bring an image of something into your mind that you absolutely love. And see if you could feel how that affects your body. Experientially, what is the feeling of love to you? So the basic process is starting with the mind, conceptualizing what it is. Your lover, or your cat, God, whatever it is that you love. See that in your mind, but then bring it down to your heart and see if you can feel it with your heart. What does it feel like to have something you love in your lap, your hands, and then drop the image and just be that in your body. Just be that.
nearby.
Now relax and just stretch for a second. I want to do another short one. That's okay. So that's the paradigm I introduced, okay? It's a three-step process. Bring it into the head. Bring it down to the heart, and we can actually hold our heart when we do it this next time. And then come back down to your body and see if you could be it, right? So let's try it again. The upright posture, then, he's not saying, I'm good or I'm bad. It's just neutral. So it lets the mind relax and be present. And try to bring yourself just into your present sense of yourself. Your present sense of yourself. I want you to remember a time when you really believed in something. It could have been something very naive a long time ago, or it could be something now. Something you really believed in. How does that feel? So first bring it into your mind. Think about it. And then go down into your heart and feel it. What did it feel like to believe in anything, from your high school to Hillary to whatever it is that you believe in? How does it feel? What kind of inspiration does that give you? And then bring that into your body and just let it be with you. Just drop the thinking and just be there. What it feels like to have love and to be inspired. The third one is come back into your mind and think about a time when you were young. Bring yourself back to when you were 4 or first time you remember anything. Who was that little person? Maybe, since we're in the mind here, look at that person objectively. What if she was here with you now? What would she be like? See if you could put your hands over your heart and hold her in your arms. You. Before all the changes shut us down, you, when things may have been fresh, or you at the beginning, when the hurt was embedded, whatever it is, a simpler, more direct connection to your history, maybe in a way you haven't seen it or felt it before. And come down into your body and feel her. Feel the little guy. Be there with them. What do you think of this person? More importantly, what does she think of you? Just bring yourself back to a meditation posture and just see if you could find an integration, a little conversation that brings you back. Back to you. And now a question I want to ask all of you while you're sitting here still, and the last thing we'll do is, how would your life be different if you really liked you? If you really believed in yourself? If you really didn't have to struggle so hard to prove anything? What would that be like?